Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Community in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through the underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. On June 9th, that would be today, California's End of Life Option Act, also known as SB 128, goes into effect, and California has now become the fifth state in the United States to permit medically assisted suicide for some and for terminally ill. The law authorizes an adult who meets certain qualifications and who has been determined by their attending physician to be suffering from terminal disease to make a request for a drug prescribed for the purpose of ending his or her life. Today's show will focus on questions and answers about what the End of Life Option Act means on both sides of the spectrum. And my guests today for the show are Matt Whitaker, who's the California State Director with Compassion and Choices, Tim Rochte, who is Compassion and Choices local San Luis Obispo team leader and ethicist, and Professor Keith Abney, a bioethicist, senior fellow in the Ethics Plus Emerging Sciences group and a lecturer in philosophy at Cal Poly. Our show is live, and we invite you to join our conversation today with your comments and questions by calling 781-3875. Again, that's area code 805. 781-3875. And welcome, gentlemen.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This law is something that goes into effect, as I mentioned, today. And this is not the first time that this law has come before California. The first time it did not pass. And this time it passed through legislature actually very quickly, from 2015 until it was signed by the governor. What was different, Matt?
Well, you know, what we saw this time, I think, is just an incredible groundswell of support spurred by the incredible storytelling of Brittany Menard. You know, and in the fall of 2014, when she shared her story, suddenly everything changed for the movement, and for us particularly as an organization, that was evidenced by our supporters nearly quadrupling after her story was shared, and our volunteers jumping upwards of 1,000 people in California who suddenly really realized that this was the moment to capitalize on this great feeling of support across the state. And people saw her story and saw the great, you know, injustice that she faced in having to leave her state. And I think that resonated with many folks who would not want to have to do the same, would not have to uproot themselves and move elsewhere. And so that really changed things. But I'll add that, you know, this first came up in California in 1992.
Right.
There was a ballot initiative. And so there have been, you know, countless numbers of people who have lent their voice to this movement in their last years, months, weeks, days, knowing that they may not see it come to fruition. And so today is a really monumental day where we kind of sit in gratitude for all of those people, and even our storytellers here in California, you know, Christy O'Donnell and Jennifer Glass, people who spent their last moments advocating for this in California, and who I think would be very proud of what's happening today.
And, you know, a huge difference, it seems, between today and what happened with Brittany Maynard and what happened in 1992 is a couple of things. First, she was very young. Do you think that resonated with people too?
Well, I think it brought relevancy to a whole different group of people. You know, Brittany and I sit, I guess, in the same generational category of the millennials, and what she showed is that this is a topic that does not just fall into one age category. It affects all of us, whether ourselves or a loved one, our family member, and also we sit at a time when there is no lack of stories of people who watched a a loved one, a mother, a father, a spouse, a child, whoever it might be, go through an excruciating dying process and beg for this option. And so I think what Brittany did is she really inspired a lot of people to be courageous and to share their stories in the way that she did, and empowered a whole new group of people to become advocates. And we owe her and her husband and her family for sharing that time with all of us a huge debt of gratitude.
The social media, too, also, I think, made a huge difference. I mean, people watched Brittany's transition from health through her progression of her illness to just days before the end of her life, did they not?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's where we saw, like I said, this whole new empowerment of a group of people who saw her story and really stood in solidarity with it. And what mm-hmm. we experienced in our organization, as the people who were helping her share that message, was just this overwhelming amount of support. In fact, it crashed our website on the day that her video launched, because we were not prepared for just so large of a groundswell of support, like you said, on social media and
right.
online, with people wanting to get involved, signing up to volunteer. It was overwhelming, and it changed everything. And like I said, we owe a great deal of gratitude to her and her family.
Tim wanted to say something.
Yeah, Chris, I just wanted to make the point that what made Brittany such a hero was that she had to move from California to Oregon, where the law is in place.
The death with dignity law.
Death with dignity law, which mm-hmm. has been going on roughly for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
But she made it, she and her husband Dan Diaz and her mother all made it their vow to each other that they wanted to have California mm-hmm. pass this legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And this dear person was making videos that were playing after
right.
she passed away that were heard by the legislators during the time that the bill was being discussed in the legislature.
Yeah, so it brought a real person into something that is still very controversial, and we're going to be talking more about that. So let's talk a little bit about the act itself. It goes into effect. It is in effect now. Who actually can make an aid in dying request under the act?
Sure. So the act specifically refers to a person who is an adult, meaning 18 years or older, is a resident of California, is terminally ill, meaning they have a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, and who is also mentally capable of making medical decisions. So this is a person who has capacity to make those decisions and to understand full informed consent in this process. And so it's a narrow door, and that's with great intention that's the case, in order to assuage any of the fears that people had around coercion or abuse. And what we've seen from our 20 years in Oregon is that this criteria really works.
And when you're talking about the concerns that went into designing the act and the fears around what could happen, talk a little bit about what some of the concerns on the other side were. If you would do that, I'd appreciate that, Keith.
Sure. Let me start by saying that one of my colleagues is a friend of Dan Diaz's, and so I have not a direct, but a connection as well. And it was a profoundly moving debate, and that Brittany did a lot to advance it. And nonetheless, there are serious issues that opponents of the act bring up. So I'm on the bioethics committee at Arroyo Grande Community Hospital. They're part of the Dignity Health System. And we had a bioethics committee meeting last week, and they made very clear, because this was the primary topic of discussion, and they handed out a presentation, a PowerPoint, of course, where they said death is a sacred part of life's journey, and we will intentionally neither hasten nor delay death. That is their policy. Dignity Health staff and physicians may not write prescriptions, may not provide a second opinion, may not witness or facilitate the act. They may not carry a medication package. Physician-assisted suicide, they say, is not a part of our mission, not allowed at Dignity Health, and not allowed in Catholic health care. Their view is that their purpose is to help people live, mm-hmm. not to help people die. That it is, this is sometimes called the health care professional role objection, that it is not the role of doctors and nurses to help their patients die. It's to help them live. And hence that it is fundamentally immoral to have patients be killed or help to be killed by healthcare professionals. It's an abrogation of their professional responsibility.
There's also been discussion about whether or not there would be more pressure on individuals based on their financial status, based on their social class, whether people would feel more pressure to take this as an avenue and make this their choice, even though they're making it their own choice, based on financial pressures because of the cost of their care.
Absolutely. So one issue, free market capitalism has always assumed that more choices is always better, mm-hmm. that if you didn't want to take advantage of a choice, that's okay. Some people will, and if you don't want to, well, that's the whole point of calling it a choice. The problem is that social psychology research and philosophy have shown that this isn't really true. If you're given additional choices when you don't want to choose them, it can turn into a kind of social pressure, even if it's not legally required, to make that choice. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly reinforced when it's a financial decision. So we can easily imagine a situation where grandpa, you know, you're costing us $10,000 a day, right? Hurry up and die. You know, they can give you the meds now to hurry up and save our inheritance, right? That's what you want to do, right, Grandpa? So, I mean, there are safeguards in the law.
Here, though, that's something that one can imagine. However, it's not been the experience. It's not been the experience in Oregon. In fact, the exact opposite has been the case. The process required for a person to go through medical aid and dying is a complex one, multiple physician visits that where people have to sign off on this, multiple eyes on the process, as well as, at this point, a very expensive medication. And, in fact, what we see in Oregon is that the majority of people who have used this option are not those on the margins of society. It's exactly the opposite. The people who have used it have been upper class, educated, white, affluent individuals. And in fact, what we have seen is that there's a real access barrier that exists for those who don't have the means and ability to coordinate through this whole care process. And so the health equity issue actually is in the opposite direction, where we are experiencing people calling us and saying, I wish I could make it through this whole process, but I don't have the financial means to do so, because either my health insurance plan is not covering it, or because I just can't wrangle through all of the different complex pieces. And so that's where our work comes in, is actually in trying to solve the opposite problem, which, while you can imagine this scenario that Keith is talking about, in actuality what's happening is quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I might jump in here and also add that another trend that has allowed California to get to this place in time is that the paternalism, if I may, that has existed for so many decades within the medical community, wherein the doctor says to do something and everybody jumped to and did what the doctor said, that's going by the wayside, and it's being replaced by a patient-centric approach to medicine. And so at the tip of the spear, if I may, of this legislation is the ethical concept of autonomy, people making a decision for themselves. And in the case that Keith brought up, I dare say that Grandpa may not be designated as mentally competent, if he was willing to follow that kind of reasoning from his children.
Well, let's go back to talking a little bit more about what the act actually is, and then let's talk about after that let's talk a little bit about some of the pros and cons for it. So we've talked about who can actually make the aid in dying request, and that's somebody who has diagnosed terminal illness with what is expected to be 6 months or less, correct?
That's correct.
Correct.
And also,
okay,
they have to have it given by two physicians.
Okay.
The law specifically states one is the consulting physician, who is the shepherd of the entire process. The second one is a consulting physician.
Well, let's talk about how does the patient make a request.
Take it away, Matt.
Sure. So a patient would go to their physician, and their first step would be to make a verbal request to that physician, so to say their intentions to want to access this law and the fact that they're informed of the steps that are in that process. So a patient would make this request, and then a physician's duty in that moment with outlining the law is actually to go over with that patient all of the alternatives that exist, all of the different end-of-life care modalities that might be accessible to this person. That patient's request is documented in their medical record, and then 15 days later, that's the waiting period outlined, they can make a second verbal request to that same physician and say, you know, I've thought about this over this waiting period of time. I still want to pursue this option. The physician then marks that request in their medical record. If that physician believes that the person qualifies, meaning that they are mentally capable, terminally ill with a 6 month or less prognosis, resident of California, all of those different pieces, and a second physician either within that waiting period or afterwards has confirmed those things, then that physician has the ability to write a prescription. I should add that there is also a written request that has to be submitted to that first physician as well sometime within that 15-day period or afterwards. Like I said, that 15-day period is the minimum, but we find it normally people, it takes about 4 to 6 weeks to get through this whole process.
Okay.
And that written request has to be witnessed by two people, one of which is not a blood relative and not someone who stands to gain financially from that individual's estate.
Mm-hmm.
That's a safeguard put in place to try to prevent some of the items that Keith was alluding to.
Right.
And then once that prescription is written, it's actually delivered directly to the pharmacy from the physician's office. So this isn't handed to someone to then take to the pharmacy. It has to go directly from physician to pharmacy, and then a person can choose to pick up that medication or not. And we find that a lot of folks in Oregon, for example, a full one-third, actually get the prescription written that never utilize it. So it's either sitting at home in their cabinet or it's sitting at the pharmacy ready to be picked up if they feel like they would need to use it. But for a full third of people, just having the option is enough.
Okay. If you just joined us, you're listening to Central Coast Voices here on KCBX Public Radio. And you are also listening to us talk about the End of Life Option Act that went into effect today, June 9th, also referred to as Death with Dignity, Aid in Dying, and Physician-Assisted Suicide. My guests for today's show are Matt Whitaker, California State Director with Compassion and Choice, Tim Rochte, Compassion and Choice local San Luis Obispo team leader and ethicist, and Professor Keith Abney, who's a bioethicist, senior fellow in ethics and emerging sciences group, and lecturer at Cal Poly. This show is live, and we invite you into our discussion today. If you have questions or comments about our topic or for today's guests, you can reach us on the air at area code 805-781-3875. Again, it's 805-781-3875. And Matt, when you were talking about the pretty much the process that one would have to go through in order to access an aid in dying assistance, Then I had a couple of questions for you. It sounds like the first step is that somebody makes a verbal request, and there's a lot of information they must receive from the physician about what other options are available to them aside from the Aid in Dying Act. Is that correct?
Sure, yeah. So the law actually says that a physician has to take the time and go through all of the different things that exist, hospice, palliative care, the option to discontinue treatment if treatment is causing symptoms that a person might not be comfortable with, whatever that might look like. It's their responsibility to have a really robust conversation around this. And what actually came out in a study a few years ago in Oregon was that when they surveyed physicians and family members, they found that for every one prescription that was written in Oregon, 25 people initiated the process. So they started this conversation. And what physicians cited was that when a person started that conversation, it opened the door to really open, transparent dialogue about wishes and values and fears. And for many people, just opening that door, having that conversation, allowed them to have some of their fears assuaged and to discover different treatment options that might be available to them other than medical aid in dying. And then for the one out of 25 who received a prescription, they were able to open that door and actually go down that route once it got to the point where they felt that that was necessary.
One of the things that a survey here in California discovered through through the Coalition for Compassionate Care was that while the majority of people wanted to have discussions with their physician about their health care, their choices, the prognosis, as few as 7% actually had any in-depth dialogue about that. Does this actually open that door so that physicians take steps into having these conversations more frequently than maybe they would have in the past?
Well, that's absolutely what we've seen in Oregon. And so after the law actually went into effect in Oregon, we saw this really robust movement to improve end-of-life care as a whole. In fact, this large task force launched called the Task Force to Improve End-of-Life Care for All Oregonians that for 10 years tracked all of the different new developments that that took place after the law passed. And now Oregon sits always in the top five for hospice utilization and access to palliative care. And there have been several, you know, journal articles published, even by people who were opposed to the law, citing it, citing this new openness to conversations and more education around it for physicians as the silver lining to the law. And so the opportunity that exists right now in California in this being in the limelight and in all of us talking about this really openly and honestly is an opportunity to completely transform end-of-life care for the better in California and to have those conversations and to, frankly, up that number from the 7% that it sits at right now as more people are engaging this, which is what we encourage people to do in the public education that Tim does, and more physicians are getting the resources necessary to be able to respond to that really patient-led process. And so we've been working tirelessly to try to develop materials for that, along with people like the Coalition for Compassionate Care and the California Hospice and Palliative Care Association, all these people who really stand to gain from a more robust and open end-of-life discussion that's going on.
And Keith, what do you think, you know, what do you think is driving this for the kind of the discussions around end-of-life care? Because when we look at how many people actually have an advanced health care directive, which is one way that they can direct their end-of-life care, the majority of Californians do not.
Right. And there's certainly been, in the history of medicine and medical ethics more specifically, a movement away from physician paternalism towards patient autonomy. And insofar as that movement comes to its logical conclusion, then we would see patients having the choice not only in what kind of treatment they're going to get when they're trying to continue living, but also having a choice over how and when and the circumstances of their death. And so if patient autonomy is always an optimal value, then it's kind of hard to argue against this as a kind of logical conclusion. Over against that, again, is that many, again, the National American Medical Association does not see things this way. They don't see it as the professional role of doctors and nurses to help their patients die. And there are serious issues that could be worrisome. So Matt and Tim, you both might want to address this, because when I teach this issue in class, one of the issues that almost always comes up are kind of slippery slope arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this ties, Matt, to the kind of financial issues you were talking about before. So right now, the procedure is rare enough in Oregon and other places where it's legal that it doesn't really make any significant difference to overall medical costs. But if this became widespread and common, we could easily see that it would save money, because a vast amount of medical spending is spent on, I mean, a ridiculous percentage is spent on people in the last 6 months of their lives. So if this became a policy emphasis, right, the worry is that there would be pressure by insurance companies and by others, even by government bureaucrats, to force people to choose this,
mm-hmm.
to force people into dying before they were ready to, because it would save money. And the related slippery slope issue is that this would then start to devalue the dying, would undermine, right, our society's commitment to give them optimal care. So I wonder if you have responses to those kinds of worries.
I can respond to your first point about the push toward, you know, the pressure on people at the end of their life. This is why it's so important to start these discussions early. For people at the age of 18, when they go in to see their physician, to talk about, to get an advance directive, for one thing. Something as simple as an advance directive can save family members a whole lot of heartache. When I was in bioethics school, the professor asked how many of you students, and by the way, most of the students were doctors and nurses, have advance directives. Most of them did not.
Correct.
I could raise my hand, and because of that, I got extra credit.
Right.
But what we are encouraging folks to do, and that is one of the major pushes of this legislation and of Compassion and Choices, is to have an early discussion with your primary physician and to sound them out on where they are. A very wise person told me, as we were first reaching out in the community to say what it was that we wanted to accomplish in terms of outreach, she said, reach out to the medical community first, because if you have the public coming and the doctors aren't aware, then you're going to have a real bottleneck. Well, I'm pleased to say that it's not just Compassion and Choices doing outreach, but the California Hospital Association has excellent guidelines. The California Medical Association has put out excellent guidelines on how to proceed with this. So now the doctors have much better understandings on what to do. But it really needs to be driven, as I'm sure Matt can speak further on, to the experience of Oregon, that people will come and speak to their doctors, and hopefully the doctors will be more prepared.
I'm going to, Matt, before you answer your question, I'm going to just take a real quick break. You're listening to KCBX, your public radio station, at 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas to Paso Robles, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and around the world at kcbx.org. The End of Life Option Act went into effect today, June 9th, 2016, in California. Since Oregon implemented its law, Death with Dignity Law, in 1997, more than a third of the people who obtained prescriptions did not take the medication. And according to the Death with Dignity National Center, the most significant impact of Death with Dignity law in Oregon has been to improve the care for all dying patients by increasing awareness among doctors, allowing an open and honest conversation, improving pain management and palliative care, and providing patients with a sense of control and peace of mind. My guests are here to talk today about what's anticipated from California's End of Life Option Act and some of the challenges faced by medical professionals, patients, and their families. Matt Whitaker, California State Director of Compassion and Choices, has joined us by telephone. Tim Rockte is here from Compassion and Choices, the local San Luis Obispo team leader and ethicist, and Professor Keith Abney, who is a bioethicist, senior fellow in ethics and emerging sciences group, and a lecturer at Cal Poly in philosophy, is also here. And we welcome the addition of your questions and comments on today's show. You can join us at 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. And Matt, getting back to the question that Keith had put before you, it was really talking about the Oregon experience of that I just cited about only a third of the people taking the medication that they were prescribed. However, the other side of the issue is that Oregon and California really are so very different in their populations, both the size of their populations, when you consider that I think it's something like 1 in 9 people in the United States lives in California. And when you look at the massive number of people who are here and the fact that when you compare the ethnicity of Oregon to the ethnicity of California, there is a lot of divergence there. So go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you are absolutely correct. Oregon and California are vastly different states. So what remains the same within this law, within this option, is that it is a solely patient-directed process. And that's why Compassion and Choices advocates for this particular choice of medical aid and buying for mentally capable adults. And why there are so many eyes on the process and the multiple physicians mm-hmm. that are involved and the fact that a person has to reiterate this request over and over again. In fact, even the California law added an extra step, which was that a person has to meet with their physician alone so that if there's any kind of coercive force at play, the physician is able to suss that out and to really get to the bottom of this, as well as provisions for people who have a mental disorder that is causing decisional capabilities to falter. A physician then has to refer out for a psychiatric evaluation. I mean, this is a robust law, and that's for a reason. It's to prevent the very things that Keith was speaking to, and to speak to the slippery slope argument. There's a reason the law hasn't changed in 20 years in Oregon. It's one, because it works, and two, because people have come to believe that this is the best way to go about this, that medical aid and dying for, once again, mentally capable, terminally ill adults with a 6 month or less prognosis is absolutely the best route to go. And that's why our organization advocates for this choice and not others that are cited on kind of the slippery slope of things. And I think if you saw any movement to expand this law in any way, you would see our organization being the first to come up in opposition to it. To speak to that, there's a reason the door is narrow in this law, and it's because it works. And our major challenge is not so much to speak to that. Our challenge is for all of those individuals who are out there and crying out and saying that they want this option, they need this option, our job is to make sure that they can get it and that their patient autonomy is honored and that their physicians have the resources necessary to respond to this. I would add that Keith brought up that the American Medical Association opposes medical aid in dying, which they do. They released a statement in the mid-90s, and they have yet to change on that, despite the fact that they are now facing immense internal pressure about that state. But the American Public Health Association, the American Medical Women's Association, the American Medical Student Association have all adopted supportive positions on medical aid and dying at the national level. Here in California, 75 different organizations, including the California Nurses Association, California Psychological Association, Primary Care Association, all came out as not being opposed to this law, including the California Medical Association dropping 28 years of opposition to go neutral during this process, saying that as physicians, they want to provide the best care possible. And despite all the remarkable medical breakthroughs that have been made and the world-class hospice and palliative care that can be provided, it isn't always enough. And they believe that it should be up to the patient and their physician to choose the course of treatment best suited for the situation. And likewise, in the most recent poll of physicians nationwide, 54% of them said that they support this option for terminally ill, mentally capable adults. And so attitudes are changing around this as more and more people see the experience that has happened in Oregon. Even some of the ethicists, people like Art Kaplan, who initially came out in opposition to the option in Oregon after seeing what has occurred, came out and said that they believe this is appropriate for other states. So California, absolutely a different place than Oregon, and that's why this option is so patient-driven and why educating on this option is something that's done mm-hmm. with cultural sensitivity and with care so that people who need it are able to utilize it. And for those who have a moral, ethical, personal issue with this, then the amazing thing is that it's totally voluntary for them, for their physician, for their pharmacist, for their nurse, for their social worker, at all steps of the process.
And when you say it's totally voluntary, what you're meaning is that no healthcare provider needs to participate, is required to participate. So if a physician, say, is morally or ethically opposed, they do not need to participate in providing any kind of aid in dying. What is their obligation, however, if a patient comes to them, their patient comes to them and says, you know, I am choosing the aid in dying, and they don't participate or don't wish to?
Sure. So you're absolutely right. No one is moved to participate. The law has a very robust conscience clause around that. But their responsibility in that moment is really to respond with empathy and with respect and with compassion and to ask further questions of that patient in that moment and to honor those wishes, whether they're theirs or not. And that's not to say that they have to participate. That's to say that they should respect that person. And so a lot of the materials that are going out, a lot of the education that's being done around the state through the medical associations, as well as through many of the academic teaching hospitals, is around how do you respond to this request with sensitivity and in a way that shows that you care for your patient. If you are someone who is not going to individually participate. And then further, what is the professional responsibility in that moment to refer to a colleague or to make sure that this person gets the resources they need, whether that be through you or through someone else? And those are conversations that are happening across the state. Many of the large health systems are putting in procedures for that, where social workers or patient advocates are coming in those moments and helping with those conversations and helping to connect people to the resources that they need. But I would say that the most important piece for any physician when a patient brings this up is to realize that the trust that must be present for a person to bring that up. I mean, it's an honor for a patient to be that honest with a physician. Mm-hmm. And to step into that space of empathy and compassion and try to leave that patient with a sense of care and a sense of hope, regardless of what that physician chooses to do.
Keith and Tim, you're involved locally with the medical communities and with the education here. And Keith, you mentioned that faith-based hospitals do choose a position about whether or not they'll participate, and locally faith-based hospitals have chosen not to participate.
Right.
How are they teaching their employees, employed physicians, or to respond when a patient does bring up the aid in dying issue?
That's an excellent question, Chris. And so, again, at the bioethics committee meeting I was at last week, the Dignity Health presentation explicitly told the doctors what they should and should not do with respect to such a request. They said that they should answer questions of the patient. They should discuss the needs of the patient. They should discuss alternatives to aid in dying. They said that they should make clear to the patients that they cannot participate in aid in dying, but they can definitely discuss the issues with them, that they should compassionately refer a patient who desires this to their primary care physician. Again, they can't be involved, but they should, if the patient is insistent, refer the patient to their primary physician. They said that they should explain palliative care as an option that is available within the Dignity Health system. They said that they should not try to shut down the conversation with the patient, especially because the reason behind the inquiry from the patient might be a very important one for the patient, and that they should not discharge a patient merely for talking about it, making a request.
Okay. And, you know, with this, I think this act says that the patient can't just go to any physician to request aid in dying, correct? It needs to be a specific physician for them. Does it need to be their primary care physician?
Initially, it should be. That's who we ask people to go to.
And if they don't have one?
Well, if they don't have one.
As many don't?
Exactly. They should try to find one. And there are a number of resources that they can use to do that, depending on what their particular need is. There are family doctors, you know, there are specialists, and this sort of thing. But I think a broader question is, even if you go to your primary physician and they choose not to participate, what do you do then? And my response is, run, don't walk, to the next available physician that does meet your needs, so that you have this in place where the doctors will support your wishes. Again, the autonomy issue is what I believe and many bioethicists believe are important, because in the final analysis, it's not what the doctor wants, it's not what your priest wants, it's not what the Pope wants, it's what you want, because it's your life and it's your choice.
Matt, with individuals who have special needs, for example, can an interpreter interpret for someone with regard to the End of Life Act? Does the person need to be able to speak in their own language to the physician, or can someone interpret that?
Yeah, great question. Not only can a person use an interpreter, but it's actually required by the law that if English is a second language for an individual, there needs to be an interpreter there, as well as the state will provide forms that are actually in that person's native language. And once again, this is a step to make sure that there is really clear communication from that individual about their intentions, and that there's not anything that's, you know, pardon my pun, lost in translation as people go through this process. And so, yeah, not only can a medical interpreter be brought in, they should be brought in for those conversations.
And is that something that Keith and Tim is being worked on locally in terms of having medical interpreters? Because that's different than having your son, daughter, or mom or brother come in and interpret for you.
Well, I can actually widen the question and not the answer right now, but you were asking before, what if your doctor isn't going to participate in this program? Where do you go? Mm-hmm. We don't know the answer right now.
Okay.
So
there's no kind of list?
There's no kind of list now, but, you know, we are into the first day, and over time we will learn, and we're so grateful to have Matt Whitaker as our statewide director because of his experience past as the director of Oregon. Another item I would mention is that we need to have pharmacists that will write this or to carry out the prescriptions. And not all pharmacists may want to participate because of moral issues.
Right.
And so we hope someday, and it may not be compassion and choices. It could be, and excuse me, I don't know the official title, but the California Association of Pharmacists, just like there may be a local association of physicians, whereas the hospitals, we have, you know, Keith is on the ethics committee for Royal Grandy, which is a Dignity hospital. I'm on the ethics committee for Sierra Vista, which is Tenet, and the other Tenet hospital in the county is Twin Cities. I was at a physicians meeting 2 days ago talking to their staff, many of their physicians, and they have not received a policy guidance from their corporate headquarters in Dallas. So this is still something that is rolling out, and we're taking it as it comes along. We don't want to give out information or try to answer questions for which there are no answers, but we definitely have numbers and online addresses that people can contact to stay informed as we are informed.
Okay. And then, Matt, on from a broader level, are there specific medications that are prescribed for this? Or is it kind of up to the choosing of the physician?
Sure. So the law, like all laws, is silent on issues that are related to kind of standard of medical practice, and that's where the medication falls. So it's really between a physician and the patient to determine what the right course would be there. However, historically, what's been used in the majority of cases in Oregon and Washington and Vermont is a medication called Seconal, and pharmacies here in California have been informed that that's what will most likely be prescribed. It's what's referenced most often in the literature, in clinical practice guidelines. So if a physician were to look up in a journal, what should I do? That's what would be outlined there, the dosage for that. And those pharmacies are aware that they're going to be getting requests for that medication. And one resource that we have for those pharmacies is actually a pharmacy-to-pharmacy hotline that people can find information about at our website, which is endoflifeoption.org. And that connects pharmacists in California to folks in Oregon who know things like who the manufacturer is, where the wholesaler is, all those different things, if they've never had to order that medication before. But what we've seen over the last few weeks is that preemptively, many of these pharmacies, as well as many of the large health systems that do pharmacy internally, have actually contacted us, gotten that information, and are now prepared for patients to begin bringing those prescriptions.
Okay, and a question, the question for you on a larger scale, what if a patient doesn't have a primary care physician? I mean, is there something that's going to be done California-wide to identify who the physicians are that are participating or accepting physicians to this? Or is it going to kind of be up to a patient who's in the last 6 months of their life to go traveling around looking for someone who's a willing participant?
Sure. So let me address that. So attending physician in the law is outlined as a person who is able to treat the patient's underlying illness. Now, what we've seen historically in Oregon is that most often a prescription is written by a person's primary care physician. In fact, most often it's a family physician who writes the prescription in Oregon. And what we don't want is what you just outlined, the person going across the state trying to find a new doctor in the last 6 months of life.
Right.
But as far as attending physician, it could be a person's specialist. It could be whoever it is that they have a relationship with and who is treating that underlying illness or is capable of doing so. And so for a person who is terminally ill, it is very rare for them not to have a physician who they have an intense relationship with. So for someone with terminal cancer, and who is
it could be their oncologist.
The last 6 months of life, they're going to have an oncologist
okay.
who is treating them for that. So
okay.
that's not as much of a concern. Or the concern is someone having to go through hoops and travel around in the last 6 months of life, and that's why we're doing all of those items that Tim was talking about of getting out there in the community and telling people, hey, if this is important to you, ask these questions of your physician early while you still have time to go and reestablish care and build a relationship with a physician elsewhere, or to really bring that physician along. What we find often in Oregon is that people go to their physician, this person who for many folks has taken care of them for years and years through this the process of their illness, or if it's a family physician. I mean, some folks go to the physician they've seen for 30 plus years who took care of their kids. I mean, really have an intense and sacred relationship with this person, and they make this request of them, and that physician may at the first not be willing to participate, or have to think on it, or have to get some more information, or have to do some learning. And if you do that early, that opens the door for that possibility. For a person who has limited time, that becomes much harder to work through that relationship with your own physician, or to find a new physician if, say, your physician's in a system where they're not allowed to participate. And so our goal is for people to have these conversations early and to be able to have them with a trusted professional whom they have a relationship with, and not have to run around in those last 6 months of life.
When is a mental health assessment required of the patient? Is everybody required to have one?
They're not. However, they are required to have their capacity assessed by their physician, and that's something that happens day in and day out in hospitals. Is that physicians have to
and
address
explain,
whether or not their patients
in
are
order
capable.
In order for someone to have capacity, what does that look like?
Sure, that means that you're capable of making your own healthcare decisions. So a person who lacks capacity, a healthcare proxy steps in and makes decisions for them because it's been determined that they're unable to understand full informed consent, whatever it might be. So when you or I go into the hospital, let's say for a procedure or for a surgery or to undergo anesthesia, whatever it might be, that physician has to assess in that moment whether or not we're capable of understanding the risks and benefits of that procedure that's taking place. And so for a person to be mentally capable, they have to be able to understand, once again with this option, what it is that they're asking for, what the risks are that are associated with it, and understand all of the different options so that they're really making a decision about this. And so if a physician questions whether a person has capacity, whether it be because they have some sort of persistent mental illness that causes capability issues or dementia or whatever it might be, they're required to send that person out for a mental health evaluation in which a psychiatrist or a licensed psychologist does a more in-depth assessment of capacity and rules on whether or not this person is indeed capable of making these decisions.
You mentioned dementia, and one of the things that is growing is the number of individuals that are affected with dementia and Alzheimer's. Because of the progression of that illness and the length of time something like Alzheimer's takes, and the fact that this needs to be done in the last 6 months of a patient's life, those Alzheimer's patients are not going to be capable of participating in this. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely not. And I would say further, you know, this is once again for a specific group of people, terminally ill, mentally capable. And for those individuals with Alzheimer's, they do not fit that description. And so, you know, what we constantly talk about with folks is the fact that we have what's called a dementia provision, which is a further advanced care planning document that people can add. It doesn't apply to medical aid in dying. However, it applies to many of the different healthcare decisions that a person's family member will have to make when a person has advanced dementia or Alzheimer's, and that's available at the Compassion and Choices website. And you're right, as more and more people are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, there needs to be a very robust conversation about how to provide advanced care planning for them. And I think that that dementia provision does just that and opens up that conversation. But completely different piece than medical aid in dying, and a completely different question that's trying to be answered there.
Can a person who is terminally ill who also has a mental disorder, would they be disqualified because they have a mental illness?
It would depend on whether that mental illness is causing issues of their mental capacity, of whether or not they have capacity in the moment to be able to make this decision. And so that's where that mental health evaluation comes in. So it's not saying that anyone with a mental disorder is to be questioned of their capacity. It's whether or not a person has a mental disorder that is affecting their decisional capability. And if that's the case, then they may not qualify for this process. But once again, that's up to them, their physicians, their mental health specialist to decide.
Yes,
Chris, I mentioned earlier about advanced directives. I wanted to be very clear that one cannot write into their advanced directive that they wish to utilize end-of-life option. That is not allowable.
Correct, yeah. Got that. And again, it has to be within the last 6 months
right.
of an estimated person's life. So you were going to say something, Kate?
And so as a philosopher, I wonder then if you guys are really truly happy with this law, because if it is truly a moral good to be able to make this choice, why shouldn't you be able to do this in advance? Why shouldn't you be able to have an advance directive that indicates that, hey, if I have late-stage Alzheimer's, I should get aid in dying? Or let's be clear, if Brittany Maynard had been 17 years old, right, then she wouldn't have been able to get aid in dying.
Correct.
So if you truly believe that this option is a moral good, shouldn't you be unhappy with the law as written?
In society, there are laws and there are regulations, and they are there to actually protect people's rights. That's why we have the law that says you have to be an adult. But there are, of course, common sense guidelines that come along that we need to abide by.
And I would add further that at the center of this process is patient autonomy up until the very moment that a person takes that medication. And due to that, that's how we avoid many of the pieces that were outlined earlier around coercion or around a person coming in and doing this to anyone. This is a self-initiated process. And so in defining the role this way, we prevent those things from happening. And this is all about patient autonomy, whereas a person making this decision ahead of time and a person having to then act upon them and do this to them opens up that door for abuse, and it completely changes things from an ethical standpoint, as I'm sure Keith would attest.
That's right. I want to thank my guests today, Matt Whitaker, California State Director with Compassion and Choice, Tim Rochte, Compassion and Choice's local San Luis Obispo team leader and ethicist, Professor Keith Abney, bioethicist, senior fellow in ethics and emerging sciences group and lecturer in philosophy at Cal Poly. And for more information about the End of Life Option Act, please refer to a couple of places. One is the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California that has a lot of information, www.coalitionccc.com. Also, the End of Life Option Organization, www.endoflifeoption.org. Next week on Central Coast Voices, Fred Monroe's host will be hosting, and he will have the Atascadero Bikers Against Child Abuse in a discussion about how they will provide support and empowerment to abused children by involving them with an established united organization. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices.